is my number.
Okay. Hi, my name is Allie, and I am joined with Amelie and Noor here. It's Friday, March 10th, and we are really excited to start our debut of our radio show called STEMinism. It's a show that's aiming to highlight new research being conducted by underrepresented groups in STEM. And it's going to comprise sort of a mashup of interviews and discussion with scientists, young and old, as well as summarizing and discussing new published research in a way that makes it easy for anyone to understand. We're really hoping to make this show as accessible to all as possible. And along the way, we're going to play some local tunes. So thank you for tuning in. We're really excited. So Amelie and Noor, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Hi, yes. So my name is Noor, and I'm a first-year PhD student at McGill University. I am Lebanese, so I actually came here straight from Lebanon, and I'm very fresh here in Montreal, so I'm still getting used to everything. And I'm very excited to be here and to talk about science.
Thanks. Hey, everyone. I'm Amelie. I am also a first-year PhD student in the neuroscience program. I'm originally from Germany and also super excited to be here. Sweet. Allie, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Allie. I'm also a first-year neuroscience PhD student. I'm from the USA. So, yeah, really, really excited to be here, really excited to be doing radio and talk about science and just kind of what makes us happy to be here. So, yeah, thank you so much again for tuning in. I kind of wanted to start off maybe describing this really cool article I read before we kind of go into a little interview session with all of us. I just think it's really cool to talk about new stuff that we've been seeing, new stuff we've been reading in the news, especially written by women and other underrepresented groups. So the other day I was reading this article published in Nature's NPJ. It's titled Parkinsonism Mutations in DNA JC6 Cause Lipid Defects and Neurodegeneration That Are Rescued by SYNJ1. And so this is a long title, but I'm just reading it out in case you wanted to go read it on your own. It's co-first authored by a woman named Julie Jackman and Sabine Kunin. They're at the KU Leuven Institute in Belgium. And the senior author is Patrick Verstreken, who's a Belgian neuroscientist. I probably butchered their names, but I tried. But I just wanted to highlight this. Julie's recently received her PhD from KU Leuven and is now here in Canada doing a postdoc in Alberta. So I just wanted to highlight some really interesting research that's been done by some young women scientists. So essentially, this article is highlighting So in this paper, they used Drosophila fruit flies to look at metabolism and the pathogenesis of Parkinson's disease, which is really relevant today, I think. So what they did is they created a knock-in model, which means that they inserted a defined DNA sequence into the flies' genomes at a specific location. And this manipulation can either replace an endogenous DNA region or add an exogenous DNA segment. And so by doing this, what they were able to do is essentially add DNA to the flies' genomes, and they were able to encode a gene for the human enzyme called auxilin, and auxilin is really important for synaptic vesicle transport. Specifically, what they did is they added mutated auxilin genes to the flies to see how the mutations of that gene would affect the behavior in the flies. And so previous research has shown that people with mutations to this auxilin gene show early onset autosomal recessive Parkinson's. This is a specific type of inheritance, which means that the two copies of the gene in each cell are altered. Most often, the patients of an individual with autosomal recessive Parkinson's disease each carry one copy of the altered gene, but they don't show signs and symptoms of the disorder. So in this fly model, the researchers were able to see that the flies with the mutated auxilin gene showed behavioral issues that were really similar to what we see in patients with Parkinson's disease. So what they saw was that the normal flies were able to climb past like a certain mark. I think it was on a cup. I don't remember exactly. In the 30-second window, they're able to climb past 4 centimeters of their their mark. But the flies that had those auxilin mutations were unable to do this task completely. Further, this was seen to be progressive, and the ability for the mutant flies to reach that mark declined with their age, mm-hmm. which is really interesting, I think. Parkinson patients are also frequently suffering from seizures. So to test if they saw similar issues happening in the flies, what they did is they vortexed the flies for 10 seconds. I think that sounds, I don't know what that means, of vortexing, but it sounds kind of scary.
It definitely sounds scary.
Yeah. But essentially what they saw was it caused strong seizure-like behavior in the auxilin mutant flies, but it didn't cause any of that seizure-like behavior in the control flies. So interestingly, the researchers noticed that in these mutant flies, there was a decrease in the levels of synaptogenin protein, which is a protein that's important for neurons to recycle synaptic vesicles. So they're like, that's weird. So they decided to overexpress the gene for the synaptogenin protein in those mutant flies. And when they did that, they saw that those seizure-like behavior like completely went away. So I think this is a really, really interesting article that was recently released like a week ago, being done by amazing young women scientists, giving us really great insights into lipid and metabolic side of Parkinson's disease and neurodegeneration, and they're really paving a path towards potential therapeutic approaches. So yeah, I wanted to highlight that and kind of explain like why I thought it was cool and what they saw.
That's super interesting. Thank you so much for sharing that. Honestly, I think you made a good job explaining that, because I had no idea, like, any background about any of this stuff.
Thanks. I had to Google a lot of the terms when I was reading it. So.
Yeah. I also wanted to say to anyone who might be intimidated by the whole description of, you know, Parkinson and whatever, I understood, like, half of the jargon that Ellie used. So we're fine.
Yeah. It's a lot. A lot to learn. But, yeah, definitely... Yeah. Read the article if you're interested. It's definitely a lot to take in, though, I will say that.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that scientists, I think, kind of forget is that most of the time you're going to end up Googling everything. And No matter how advanced you get in your career, you're always going to be doing that. You're never going to have the full expertise to not learn. It's like a constant learning.
Yeah, our main soft skill is using Google very efficiently.
Yep. It's quite accurate.
Yeah.
And it's also a cool paper, because I don't think that many people know that we use flies as a model system. Yeah. And that, like, some people apparently spend their day vortexing flies.
Yeah, imagine that. Yeah, there's this guy that is in the lab down the hall from my lab who does his work in fish. And I think they're looking at MS in fish, if mm-hmm. I'm remembering exactly, but essentially, like, they want to look at these movement disorders in these fish, and so they just put the fish in like a small tank that is like just throwing like water at them. It's like it's water, but it's like pressure, so they have to swim against this really intense stream, and they just sit and watch these fish for hours and like videotape these fish just swimming against the stream to see like how long it takes them to fail. And it's I think it's really funny, because when you think of science and like being in a lab, I think you think people are doing these really sophisticated things, but it's like we're just looking at fish and flies like fail. Like, I don't know how to explain it, but
we're just really mean to animals.
So mean.
all with good intentions in the end, and with goals.
One of my friends always describes her like day-to-day life as moving liquids from one like vial to the other.
It's accurate. Half the time I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm just following a protocol, and I'm like, well, this pink liquid goes in here, and now it changed colors, and I have no idea why. And I know I could look it up, but I'm too busy.
Yeah. You know, one of my favorite researchers, it's a lab back in Northwestern. They use fruit flies to study sleep, which is so interesting. Because I initially never thought that, like, you'd think of flies first for sleep. But because most organisms have some kind of dormant state, it includes flies.
And, that's interesting.
And they're able to, like, manipulate specific genes in the fruit fly to either prolong REM sleep or to completely abolish REM sleep. And I think it's super interesting.
Oh, that's really cool. I didn't know that you could look at sleep in flies, but that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Should we put on the ad? I don't know.
We can try.
Okay. We're supposed to play an ad in this hour, so we're going to attempt to play the ad for you. But if not, if it doesn't work, I can put on the song.
Yeah.
Or we can play some music.
Yeah.
CKUT is hiring a spoken word assistant.
Working in collaboration with a spoken word coordinator, the spoken word assistant will be responsible for helping develop and maintain our community news, arts and culture, and social justice-focused programming.
To get an idea of the kinds of spoken word programming we make at CKUT, check out our spoken word blog on our website or tune in to our daily programming.
Responsibilities include liaising with new and current CKUT volunteers, some basic audio editing and technical help in our studios, and help in finding interesting programming to air when the need arises.
Interested in grassroots journalism, knowledge of Montreal's community organization and arts and culture scene, and an ability to speak French and English are assets.
CKUT prioritizes the unique contributions that marginalized communities bring to our organizations and encourages these individuals to apply.
This is a four-month contract worth 15 hours per week at $16.20 an hour.
For full details about the position, please check out our website at ckut.ca.
If interested, please send a cover letter and your CV to hiring@ckut.ca. The deadline to apply is March 14th at 5 p.m.
So you just listened to Imuta by Beatrice Deer. She's a half Inuit, half Mohawk singer who moved to Montreal in 2007. And that song features traditional Inuit throat singing. I think it's a really pretty song. It really makes me want to get up and dance.
I love that.
Yeah, check out Beatrice Deer, local artist. She's really cool. I like every song I've heard from her so far.
Thank you so much for sharing. I love it.
Yeah. So after taking a small break from talking about science, let's get back into it. We were talking about fly models. What kind of models have you guys worked with? Have you worked with cells, like patients, mice, rats, cats, like frogs? What's your experience been? What have you thought about it? What do you like? What do you not like?
So I worked so far with rodents. I worked with birds. I worked with humans. Definitely very different experiences in each one. So currently I'm working with rodents, specifically with rats. I'd say they have a very social kind of personality, if you want to call it. They kind of get used to you. So it's kind of interesting working with them and also challenging at the same time, because you have to learn how to compartmentalize and like think, oh, this is not my pet. This is a lab animal that I'm doing studies on. Working with humans is very different because you're basically like you're interacting with people. You're not really thinking about them as research subjects, but you have to get over this bias and like focus on analyzing their answers. For example, if you have a questionnaire with them, you have to really focus on the rational and scientific aspect of their answers and just kind of ignore any personal ways in which you relate to those things. And I feel like that's especially challenging when you start doing research in topics that are tend to be personal or like struggles that people go through. And I've also worked with birds to study vocal learning, because it's very similar to how humans learn how to say words.
That is so interesting.
It's super cool. They basically, there's a circuit in their brain which kind of gives them a reward feedback every time they say a syllable the right way. So when they learn their songs, there's a specific order and duration for the syllables that they have to say. And it's very, very similar to how humans learn how to say words. So by studying birds, you're able to kind of generalize it to stuttering disorders, for example, or other vocal like learning disorders that humans experience. And it's all very different aspects of science. What about you, Amelie? What have you worked with?
I've worked both with humans and in cells. Humans are fine, I guess. They're annoying in many ways. And I initially, when I started the PhD, I was pretty set on working on cells, because I thought, A, they're not as moody, and B, you could get more into like the basic science things and like explain what happens in the brain better than just looking from the outside. But once I tried it, I realized it's not necessarily better. It's just a different way of doing things. And like the whole idea of research is different in that you just experiment a lot. Like it's literally what I did in kindergarten, like throwing different liquids together and seeing what comes out of it. And with cells, you put stuff on it and see what happens and hope you see something. And that's terrifying to me. but it's also pretty cool to like grow your own neurons and see them actually, you know, doing stuff.
That's very cool. Would you say neurons are moody after all?
Definitely. And they have different personalities, and that some, they just want to fuck you up. And, you know, they just start differentiating on your plate and they're useless.
Yeah.
So annoying.
Yeah, it is very annoying, I bet.
Yeah, I remember seeing the photos you would show of your organoids, and I was so impressed. But then I would hear about the struggles of, like, neurons differentiating and the whole plate going shit.
Yeah. And sometimes people have to throw away, like, 3 months of work because of contamination or, you know, things happening. It's frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like with cell work, it takes a lot more time to get results that are, like, you need to have more experiments and have to have a fuller story to publish, if that makes sense. While with human work, you can really publish small things mm-hmm. at a time. Like, as you're building the story, you can write the story in bits and pieces and people will be interested in reading it. But when it comes to cell work, like, it really takes years of work and experiments and trials to finally have a story that you can put together and yeah. publish.
Yeah.
It's quite different.
With humans, the story is much more obvious.
Yes.
And, like, so much yeah. easier to explain, even to lay people. With cells, you have to build a whole thing around it.
Absolutely.
You have to have evidence, like hardcore yeah. concrete evidence, or, like, no one's going to believe you, which yeah, I think
yeah.
is good.
Yeah.
Like, sure. like, you can't, shouldn't just be able to get away with anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going yeah. into it is definitely a high risk for graduate students, like, for them
yeah.
to go into something where they know it's going to take them years
exactly.
to be able to publish one thing. And if something goes wrong or they turn out to be wrong about this whole thing, then it's a big risk to go into it. And I'd say it's kind of the same for animal research, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can be on year 5 or 6 of your PhD and have no publications.
Yeah.
And, like, that's not that uncommon,
it's
I think,
not.
In non-human research.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something to, I think about when you pick a field like this.
Yeah. On the other hand, when we look at your mitochondria tubules and the pictures
the
you
Mickey
took.
Mouse. I mean... I found a cell when I was at the microscope the other day that there was, it was basically 3 cells, but when you just look at the mitochondria staining, it looks like Mickey Mouse, and it's really cute, and it means nothing for scientific research, but it was really fun. So yeah, definitely fun aspects to it. Yeah, it's very different.
Yeah, I think there's a growing popularity now of fun being integrated into
yeah.
science more and
yeah.
more, and I think that's how it should be. Like, I feel like people, particularly, you know, old men, will
yeah.
kind of gatekeep science and, like,
yes.
take it to be a very serious subject devoid of art or fun. And I feel like there's now a movement that's, like, aimed at changing the notion of what science can be.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty awesome.
Honestly, I was shocked when one of my friends, who's also a PhD student here, told me that he's never experienced joy in, like, reading an article, because, like, he does it for the career path, I guess, but he's not really, like, deeply interested in the thing. I'm like, what are you doing here then? Like, isn't that the whole point of going into research?
Yeah.
Also, you need the whole fun part to actually get through it and build
yeah.
up the resilience to do the whole thing.
Absolutely. So. I don't think science now is built in that way. Like, I think it's still pretty inaccessible the way journals are. Like, you have to pay a huge sum of money or be enrolled in a university, which is already, like, a very small proportion of the population, to be able to read scientific articles. And when you read them, it's in, like, lingo that is very difficult to understand. So I definitely think that there are barriers on both sides. Like, people feel discouraged by science and they don't feel like taking it as something that can be fun and enjoyable. And then science itself having a very, let's say, unattractive appearance.
Yeah, but that's what we love science outreach for.
Yeah.
And it's probably the only thing I like about social media, that it allows you to make it a bit more fun and accessible to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. There's a really big Twitter presence of scientists now, which is, I didn't realize until, like, 2 months ago, but there's pretty much everyone I know that's in the field of science is actively on Twitter
yeah.
and, like, posting about different papers that are coming out and, like, the different conferences they're going to. And it's just a big hub of information that I never really realized, because I don't know, when, like, Elon took Twitter over, I was like, I'm not gonna use this.
Yeah.
But
during the pandemic, people definitely became more and more vocal about sharing science. Like, there's a lot of accounts on Instagram and TikTok as well that kind of take random topics in science about animals, about the cosmos, and just try to break it down to the public in, like, short digestible videos, which are actually super cool. Like, I think some people paint it as, oh, we're going backwards as a society. TikTok is ruining the brains of our children and whatnot. And you could say it's partially true and it's not being regulated well. But at the same time, there's a lot of new facts that I learned about random animals like jellyfish and tardigrades and whatever that I learned from watching these videos. And I think that's definitely like a positive step forward. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with that. There is also misinformation everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's not something you're ever going to be able to get away from.
Yeah.
But I have seen some people on TikTok, like nutritionists and scientists and doctors, who are genuinely trying to use the platform to spread knowledge about just all sorts of different things. And I think they're trying to help stop that spread of misinformation, like have some credible information on the app. And I think that's really cool to see, like, how we're adapting to the new technologies that we're seeing and trying to train the youth, I guess.
That's exactly it. Let's just all get a Twitter account and an Instagram account and, like, overwrite all the misinformation out there.
It's a lot of work.
It is.
So this kind of segues me into my next question for you guys. It's kind of a two-part question, so I wanted to start off by asking you a little bit about your background, your research background, like what kind of work have you done, but with that, like, what has it been like to be a woman in STEM today? So I know it's like a big,
that's a loaded question.
Let's just start with, like, you kind of, I know we introduced ourselves, but if you could actually just tell me a little bit more about your research background before you came here and, like, what makes you interested.
Sure, yeah. So I did my undergrad in electrical and computer engineering back in Lebanon. I did not choose it because I wanted to do it. I actually always wanted to do neuroscience. It's just that in Lebanon and in my university, doing ECE seemed to be the most direct way of getting into neuroscience. So that's what I did. And I think you could, like, you hear a lot of stereotypes and rumors about what it's like being a woman in engineering. And I could say that a lot of them were true. Like, you feel the way that people kind of underestimate you sometimes, professors and your colleagues. Now, luckily, I was surrounded by friends that always made me feel included and never made me feel like I was left out, but you could definitely sense it in, like, the bigger engineering community. So I guess that kind of feeds into it. In neuroscience in specific, I've always been interested in studying sleep and understanding how sleep plays a role in consolidating our memories and all these kinds of regulatory processes. And it definitely kind of branched into an interest in a lot of different subfields in neuroscience. But I'd say that the understanding sleep, which is something that we spend a third of our lives doing, and not many people know why we do it still, is pretty interesting to me and definitely one of the big fundamental questions. And that's what I'm hoping to do right now in grad school. So I want to join a lab. I'm in the rotation program right now, so I still haven't figured out which lab I want to join, but I do hope that I end up in a lab which allows me to study sleep, even if it's not like a focus, but at least studying sleep is an aspect of the science. It's definitely something that I'm interested in.
I can't wait to see that research. Yeah, I'm originally a speech and language pathologist, so I didn't get into research until, like, pretty late in life, I guess. I lost the train of thought there.
You're a speech and language pathologist? Is that what you said?
Yeah. So I did my undergrad in speech and language pathology, and I thought I wanted to work with kids. But during the first internship I did, I figured out, like, I absolutely hate it. You have to be a clown for them. And that's not me. Definitely not me. But also in the first semester, we had a neuroanatomy class and got to go to a pathology lab where we, like, could hold a brain and saw the brain slices and things. And I saw a lot of neurological patients with, like, the funniest language disorders. Like, my favorite patient could only say the letter G, So he would talk in like which is, I mean, I feel so bad for him, don't get me wrong, but it's also so fascinating. And that's when I decided I have to get, like, I have to learn more about the brain. And then I did my first master's in neurolinguistics. But that felt really limiting at a point, because there's only so much you can do with language research, I guess. And it's always very surface level. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really feel like you're helping patients a lot, because you always reach a point where you just can't go any further. And that's when I decided to do the second master's in neuroscience, to get more into like cell biology. And that's how I got here, also in the rotation program.
That's super impressive. I really admire your like will to just not being satisfied with the information that you have and just going for it. It's like, yeah, I'm gonna learn this, I'm gonna learn that, I don't care. Like, it's definitely really admirable.
Thank you. Other people call it crazy.
It's not crazy. It's not crazy. You know, this is the thing. When guys do it, they say, oh, that's so inspiring, he's such a go-getter. But they always make it seem like when a woman does it, it's like, oh, like, don't you plan on having a family? And it's so weird. And I feel like, no, like, you should definitely keep on doing what you're doing and just...
Definitely heard that a lot.
Like, yeah.
If you start your PhD now, you're going to be too old by the end of your finish. And like, then you're never going to go to work because you'll have children by then. I'm like, what?
Like, yeah, like, who told you I'm going to have children anyway?
Yeah, like, who determined that fate for me? Like, that children was my path, right? You know, like, and also there's plenty of women that have children and families and work and like follow their dreams.
So. Yeah, just get a trophy husband.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm actually pretty thankful for like being in a different field for a while. It was mostly women doing it, of course, so it kept me away from all the misogyny for a while, because, you know, there's just no men there. So I'm actually really shocked now that I'm here. At like the level of problems that we actually have with it.
It's almost like a weekly occurrence, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. Like daily
probably. I guess that goes kind of into my next question. We can just segue there, like, what is like being a woman in STEM today? I just wanted to start, like, I used to work with patients that were dealing with something called REM sleep behavior disorder, which is a disorder where you act out your dreams, and about 70 to 80% of these patients will end up developing Parkinson's or dementia or some other synucleinopathy within 20 years of that sleep disorder diagnosis. And so I mostly worked with older men because it is really prevalent in men, and it was really interesting working with these older men because they would make comments about my appearance. They would make comments about how they wanted to have sex with me, and just, it was all very vulgar.
God. I'm so sorry.
But then when I had like male coworkers work with the patients that I refused to work with anymore, they'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, he was telling me about how such a smart young man I am and how I'm gonna, you know, go do great things, and ask me if I'm planning on trying to become a doctor and go to medical school. And it's just like the vast difference in how like men treat us, I think, as women in STEM, is just like a daily reminder. I think
that kind of reminds me, while I was working as a therapist, I had a lot of old male patients, and I always felt like I had to win their trust or like prove myself to them. So in the beginning, they usually came into the room like, What can this young woman tell me? Like, I know this better than her, even though she has the freaking degree. And after like 2 to 3 weeks, they noticed that I actually know my shit, and the things I'm telling them are helping them. And then we'd be fine. Like, we'd be best buddies. But before then, it's always a little struggle.
Yeah. And it's like your male counterparts don't have to have that hurdle to overcome with their patients. Like, their patients immediately trust them.
Yeah. They'd be talking about their male physical therapists. I'm sorry. Like, they're the best. They know what they're doing. And they told me this and that.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Yeah. You know, like, I feel like for a woman to get respect in her field, she has to be exceptional. Whereas, absolutely, yeah, like men can just be do the very bare minimum and they'd be given that respect without like a second thought. And it's truly insane. And you know, the thing you mentioned earlier about how your patients would like harass you, basically.
Yeah.
What I hate about it is that the fact that they treat the young men differently and the fact that the young men that are your colleagues don't believe you because they're being treated differently mm-hmm. is a big issue.
It's a big issue. And I think that's an issue in like more than just STEM, like political science, you know, name a field, like women are always treated differently than men mm-hmm. and treated as it's a hobby, right? Like I have friends that would agree, like, this is your hobby. If you mm-hmm. want to like, yeah, I don't know. And men, it's like, oh, it's a career. They're driven. And because they're treated that way by others, they don't see what we experience in our daily lives.
Yeah.
You kind of have to stand up for yourself twice, like once to the people actually harassing you and then once again to people you're telling it to.
Absolutely. It sucks when you have to convince the people that are supposed to believe you that you have to kind of put up a front with them too, mm-hmm. to tell
so
them you
gaslighting.
Yeah, like you have to believe me that like this actually happened, this person is actually misogynistic, mm-hmm. this person actually did this and that, and just because they're nice to you or just because you never experienced that, it doesn't mean that I'm not experiencing that. It really speaks to the privilege, you know, of like different people.
Hi, I'm the tech and I'm not in STEM, but I do have a question because I experienced this and I work in politics. Do you ever get accused of being like a diversity hire? Because I get that all the time where people are like, oh, you're just here to like up the diversity quota and not because you're actually good at what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. I haven't because I'm white, but I have heard people say that all the fucking time. And it's like, no, like they're just smarter than you. Like it has nothing to do with that. I hear that all the time.
Yeah. It hasn't happened to me in specific, but again, I'm white too.
It has happened with me because I'm Lebanese, I'm Middle Eastern. Actually, not too long ago, I met someone at some social. I can't remember their name. They were talking about, so the rotation program here at McGill is kind of selective, very selective. And when I mentioned like, yeah, it's all girls this year, like that's pretty cool. And he was like, oh, like, that's so weird. Like, how come they are excluding men like that? And then he was like, well, wait, where are you from? And I was like, what does this have to do with anything? And he said, yeah, well, it's just curious. I'm just curious. And I said, oh, I'm Lebanese. And he's like, ah, that explains it.
Oh, my God.
And I would have punched him on the spot.
I was just so angry. I was so angry. Like, I don't get it. I really don't get it. You see someone, like, even if I am just a quote-unquote diversity hire, or I'm just, you know, filling the quota or whatever, what makes you think it's okay for you to say something like that to someone? Like, I never question why some of my colleagues that I feel are not qualified enough to be in their positions are in their positions. I'm just like, okay, I guess they proved themselves. I never, like, I keep my opinions to myself, you know, and then most of them are typically men that have really big egos and they think they know what you're talking about, like, when it's something that you have studied and they have just read one article about. So
they try to mansplain your own research to you.
Yeah. I'm sure you've heard about this one time where this guy was mansplaining research to another woman and he cited an article and she was the one who wrote that article.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. But I hate how common this is.
Yeah.
And to like go back to the diversity thing, it's definitely experienced. And I didn't think I would experience it, but I experienced it way too much to not talk about it.
Yeah. That makes me think, I remember like just in general, like watching different lectures by other students and like sometimes, this is gonna sound like I'm a bitch, but sometimes I feel like I'm watching a white dude talk about his research and he doesn't really know what's going on. He doesn't really know how to answer the questions that people ask once he's finished with his presentation. And I just can't help but think, like, is this, like, the average white dude that got here because he's an average white dude, while like all these women and people of color have to, you know, be three times as good to get the same position. Mm-hmm. And like, I feel like I've noticed that quite a bit, and it's quite disheartening, if I'm being honest.
And on a social aspect too, not just the admissions process. Like you have a guy who admits, yeah, actually, I don't know much what I'm talking about. And everyone's like, ah, that's funny. Like, yeah, it's good to admit that you don't know something. But God forbid a woman says that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, it's like, oh, well, like, you know, you just have, they start like giving her this patronizing advice of like, you know, it's actually not that difficult to understand. You just need to think about this and that.
Or like, do your research, like, you know, be prepared, more prepared.
Yeah. It's like, why do women have to show up at 200% on every single social event or any kind of conversation that they have? And men get to just not.
Did you know that women only apply to jobs if they fulfill like 100% of the criteria that are asked for? Whereas men apply if they have like 60% of the criteria.
Seriously?
Just the audacity.
Yeah. Seriously, they apply if they have 60% of the criteria?
Yep.
That's crazy. I can't imagine doing that.
City, yeah.
And then they probably get paid better.
That's
even though they're not as qualified. They have less qualifications.
Well, let's not even go there.
Yeah. That was like my old job. I was like the senior research assistant, and they hired this guy who was... He had a master's degree, but it was in public health. It wasn't neuroscience related. He had like pretty much no research experience. And I was supervising him and training him. And I found out that he was getting paid $15,000 more than me. And his starting salary was $25,000 more than my starting salary had been. And simply because he's like this white dude that happened to have an uncle that worked at the... like pretty high up in the hospital I worked at, and like I just remember like all of us finding he was very, very open about how much he was making, and the rest of us were making at least $15,000 less than him, and we're like, you've got to be kidding me, we've all been here years, we all have way more experience. And there was this woman in my lab, a woman of color, who's making like even less than the rest of us. Even though she almost had a PhD, and it was just like really made me realize like how fucked up, sorry, excuse my language, like
it's okay,
the salary and just like is in like science and just political, like everything. I think just in general, like women make less money even though they're more qualified, and it's just
so disheartening.
Yeah,
but the good news is in Germany, I think last week, like a woman sued her company for paying her less than a newly hired colleague with like the same kind of qualifications, the same job title, just because he negotiated better in the interview. Like that's what the company said. Like he's just a better, like more confident negotiator. That's why he gets more. Like you should have negotiated better. And actually she won the case, and like the court said that can't be an argument.
Yeah.
Like it has to be based on qualifications or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we get too angry here, do you want to play another song?
Yeah.
Yeah. I will pull up the song right now. Up next, we're going to play Birds by Dominique Fizeme. Is that how you say it, I think?
I have no idea how you pronounce that.
Fizeme. Yeah. The Quebecois over here pulling us through. Thank you. Yeah, I think she's a Montreal singer-songwriter. It's going to be really jazzy, which we like for a Friday afternoon. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Hope you enjoy it.
The sound of the birds taking off scared you last night. Though they were right to leave, right to use their wings to fly. So the sound of the birds taking off scared you last night. Though they were right to leave, right to use their wings to fly. I just can't figure out, is it too late or too early? Is it right on time? Could it be right on? If the crow said it right, we could move out by dawn early. Could be right on time. Could be right on. So the sound of the birds taking off scared you last night. Though they were right to leave, right to use their wings to fly. So the sound of the birds taking off scared you last night. Though they were right to leave, right to use their wings to fly. Kai staring at the ceiling, still traveling fears. Thinking if you rise, I rise. We'll be waiting for the morning, he'll crumble in strength. Again, if you rise, I run, I. Sound of the birds taking off scared you last night. Though they were right to leave, right to use their wings to fly. The birds taking off scared you last night. Though they were right to leave, right to use their wings to fly. I just can't figure out, is it too late? Too early? Mm-hmm. Can't figure out, is it too late? Too early. Can't figure out, is it too late?
Is it too late?
Is it too late?
Too early.
You just heard Birds by Dominique Fizeme. That was one of Amelie's picks, so thank you for sharing that. I really liked it. So to kind of continue our, I guess, kind of Women's Day, Women's Week type of debut to our show, do you guys want to talk about some women that have influenced you, women that you look up to in your life?
Yeah, definitely. So actually, I've always been kind of interested in the brain, but I think the moment that I realized this is what I want to study in my life, it happened over multiple occasions, but a very big moment was when I watched this TED Talk by this professor at MIT. Her name is Dr. Nancy Kanwisher, and she had this TED Talk that's called A Neural Portrait of the Human Mind. And she discussed how she was able, using fMRI research, how she was able to basically isolate different regions in the brain for different functions. And I thought it was super interesting. And she closed her TED Talk with a statement, if you don't mind me quoting it, because I think it kind of really stuck with me. She basically said, and this is kind of, I guess, an abridged version of what she said. She said, "Fixing things that are broken in the world is not the only thing that's worth doing. What could be more thrilling than to understand the fundamental mechanisms that underline human experience, to understand in essence who we are? This is, I think, the greatest scientific quest of all time." And like, she said this in her TED Talk, and I was like, you know what? I agree with you. Like, she really sold it. And I think just the way that she carried herself in that talk, it really made me feel like, wow, like, this person could be someone like me, you know, it could be a woman, because in Lebanon and, like, we're always surrounded by like male physicians and male scientists and male engineers and male everything. And I never thought, like, I never thought that it could, like, yeah, that person could be me, you know? And so Dr. Nancy Kenwisher definitely left like a big mark on my journey. And I looked up her research and I was super fascinated, and kind of got me to start reading books and stuff about the brain. And although now my interests have diverted from that, like from this initial topic, I still really agree with the fundamental thing of what she said. It's like, it's not just about like diseases. And although this is super important and it should be the primary goal, but it's not just about that. Like, it's a deeper, bigger thing. It's like exploring the universe that is, you know, above our shoulders. It's incredibly awesome. And it's definitely something that inspires me every day.
It's such a great story about how you got into neuroscience. And it just shows you how important representation is, because like, who knows where you would have ended up hadn't there been this TED Talk by this woman.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Like, I don't know. I was just scrolling through YouTube, and I'm not like usually a fan of listening to motivational talks a lot of the time, because I always feel like there's this hidden story that the speakers don't talk about. Like, you know, all those successful people, the way they talk about how they got their ideas and how they were able to launch the startup and now how it's a multi-million dollar company or stuff like that. This stuff never really like spoke to me, but this talk, like seeing it and seeing like, wow, okay, she did all that. Like, that's incredibly interesting. And learning the kind of woman she is, like as a professor, she shaved her head in class and drew the different areas of the brain on her head.
Iconic.
To show her students what to do with. She had one of her students apply TMS on her own brain to show how different areas of the brain map out to the different, like, our different limbs. So, like, over the motor cortex. TMS is transcranial magnetic stimulation, basically using a big magnet to stimulate the brain. And this is just someone who's very committed. And I know that, like, there are controversies. Like, a lot of people don't agree with her research, for example. But I could say that's very true about
a
lot of different things. And I think that even if you don't agree with, like, her research or her conclusions, just her drive and her motivation to be so committed to delivering science with such passion is very inspiring. Like, I hope I become a professor like that one day. I don't know if I'd shave my head in class, but like, I'd want to do something that's on par with the passion and the enthusiasm.
What about you, Allie?
My undergraduate supervisor is Dr. Serena Satter, and she is, I think, the coolest name ever. But she's a really amazing woman. Her work is all about oxytocin systems and like this idea of moral elevation and altruism and epigenetics. So she's really interested in looking at like how women pass on epigenetic profiles of the oxytocin system and like resilience. I learned a lot from her about like this idea of neuroscience on a more kind of like positive level. Like, she would often say things like, well, like, why do we only study the negative aspects of research? Like, we're only looking at disease and depression and anxiety, but why can't we be looking at more positive things like resilience and post-traumatic, like resilience and these different kinds of things. And so her work was really about that and like uplifting research. And how about you, Amelie?
I wanted to mention two people. The first one is my supervisor from my second master's. Her name's Hyuna. She's a postdoc in the lab that I was working in at King's College London. And she's just the most like lovely, encouraging, supportive person ever. Like, I had the worst supervisors before. A lot of them male, but you know.
Who would have thought?
And like, she was just like actually there for me. And knew how to mentor people. And she's like a real badass. Can I just say that? Like she doesn't take anything from anyone else.
That's awesome.
And that's what I aspire to be at one point.
Yeah.
Right, and the other person is Frida Miller. She's a professor at UBC in Vancouver, studying precursor cells in the brain and like neural repair. And she did a talk here in Montreal, and she's also like the nicest person. And I love how she got so successful without like losing her like humanity, because I feel like sometimes you have to become really rough as a woman if you want to be successful. And like she kept the like being a nice person. I don't know.
Yeah, that is such a big thing. Yeah. Absolutely. It's like if you want to be successful, you have to be cutthroat.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think there's like, I also want to mention like my current supervisor in the rotation program, Heidi McBride. She's like a very prominent figure, I would say, in the field of mitochondrial research. I was really refreshed when I met with her, when I interviewed with her to do this rotation with her, like just her enthusiasm and excitement for science, even, you know, all these years later, now that she's a senior scientist, she's still just so excited to be here and be doing science. And it was really refreshing because I feel like a lot of the mentors that I've had in the past have been quite disillusioned by this point. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, just they don't have that excitement and just desire to learn whatever they can anymore. And so that was a really big draw of why I picked this lab. And she's just so inspiring, and she's a mother and a big figure in the field. And it's a really amazing to work with women like this that are still excited to be here. And it makes me want to be like that when I'm a scientist. Yeah.
I'm so happy you got into that lab.
Yeah, me too. I really like this lab so far.
I'm very excited to see like how this will influence you, even if you don't choose this lab in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Either way, like I'm getting such amazing experience out of it that it's just going to be valuable no matter what. And I really think that about the rotation program. Like, so for all of you who are listening that are interested in a PhD in neuroscience at McGill, very specific, you should definitely look into the rotation program. I think it harbors a lot of skills. And
go do it. We love it.
And it gives us this amazing community. Like, it allowed me to be close with Allison and Amelie, which are one of the most amazing women I've met. So,
yeah.
Right back at you.
Yeah. So with that, we have a minute left. I wanted to close out and thank you all for tuning in. This has been our debut of our new show called STEMinism. We're really excited to present to you research that we've read in the news recently, just talk to other scientists, all of which has been coming from women and other underrepresented people in STEM. I think it's a really important issue to discuss. So thank you so much for tuning in, and tune in next time. Anyhow, anyways, I don't know what I'm saying. And I'll call me out myself, I don't care. Your beauty, mama, it's all. Yeah.